mouth or on his face. Not yet. Sophie was so long in trying to organize her thoughts into coherent sentences that she was startled by the cry of the bailiff bringing the room to order and announcing Judge Micah Stewart's court in session. The judge came out of the antechamber, his head of snow-white hair standing out not just for its abundance, but for the contrast to a mustache and brows that were still a carroty red. He paused before taking his seat, looking over the spectators, nodding to bailiffs and roundsmen and colleagues. Then his gaze came to rest on Anthony Comstock. And even from halfway across the room, Sophie saw the disdain darken his expression.
"Mr. Comstock,"
Judge Stewart said in a dry voice that still managed to fill the room.
"Up to your old tricks, I see."
If it weren't for the seriousness of the situation, Anna would have enjoyed watching Judge Stewart sparring with Anthony Comstock. Comstock could not hold his temper or keep his opinions to himself. What he lacked in rational argument, he made up for with posturing, thundering rhetoric, and Bible verses, a tactic that was not serving him well.
"You can't summarily dismiss the charges," Comstock was saying in a patronizing tone. "The grand jury handed down the indictment, and you must proceed and allow me to prosecute this case."
Stewart leaned back in his chair.
"You might be right."
Comstock looked genuinely surprised.
"In fact, if there were a legal indictment, you would be right," the judge went on. "But District Attorney Wilson found insufficient cause to let you bring your complaint before the grand jury, as he told me just an hour ago. So you snuck behind his back, didn't you? Crept into the grand jury room like a thief in the night and approached the foreman directly with your complaints."
Comstock sputtered.
"The district attorney was very busy and I..." "You took it upon yourself to wheedle an indictment out of the grand jury even after you were told the case wasn't solid enough to prosecute." "Judge Stewart," Comstock began again, "have you looked at the material we seized from Dr. Garrison's office? You ignore my question to ask one of your own. If you have looked at those materials, you know that the defendant's purpose is to distribute, unlawfully distribute, immoral and obscene tracts and implements, and thereby to pollute the public and cast the innocent into mortal danger. The first indictment concerns the booklet that Dr. Garrison herself pressed into Inspector Campbell's hands, one that instructs women how to prevent conception."
Sophie sat up straighter, craning her neck to catch sight of Comstock where he stood.
"What?" Anna whispered. "That's Mr. Campbell there with Comstock. It was his wife I was attending yesterday when you went off to Hoboken."
Judge Stewart was saying,
"As it happens, I have read the pamphlet you mention here. Read it twice, and nowhere did I come across the word conception. Plenty about hygiene and health, but nothing about procreation or conception or anything along those lines." "You read the word syringe, did you not?"
Comstock demanded.
"Certainly." "Well, then."
"Well, then what?
You know what syringes are used for, sir."
"I think I do, yes. But maybe it's time we allowed the defense a word or two. Dr. Garrison?"
Clara raised her voice to be heard clearly. "Female syringes are first and last a therapeutic tool, Your Honor. The syringe is indispensable in the treatment of disease and for applying local remedies to preserve personal health. Syringes are also used in the irrigation and cleaning of wounds and body cavities."
"Hogwash!"
The judge drew back sharply.
"You forget yourself, Comstock."
"Dr. Garrison, do you have anything to add?"
"No, Your Honor."
Comstock's voice rose to an indignant wobble.
But the publications Dr. Garrison distributes so freely are an incentive to crime to girls and young women.
I don't see it.
Great evil, Comstock shouted, is often very subtle.
Too subtle for me,
Judge Stewart said. And to Anna, it seemed certain that he was trying not to smile.
I find nothing unlawful here. The first indictment is hereby struck.
Your Honor, I am a representative,
Mr. Comstock. Listen closely. I do not care to hear about your society, and if you interrupt me again, I will find you in contempt. If you'll permit me to share Judge Benedict's rulings,
he put his hand on the papers before him. Stewart's expression hardened.
You may not, he said. I am not bound by Judge Benedict's rulings. The Society for the Suppression of Vice.
I think you must be hard of hearing, Comstock. Unless you have something worthwhile to say, I am going to dismiss the rest of your charges.
Comstock grabbed a book and held it overhead, turning to show it to the room.
Niemeyer's Anatomy, he bellowed. Found on Mrs. Garrison's shelf, plain as day. Mr. Campbell, is that not so? Did you not find this book on Dr. Garrison's shelf?
A man much shorter and leaner than Comstock came to his feet and removed his hat to reveal a head of frizzy red hair.
It is. Independent verification, Comstock thundered. I submit to the court that this is an obscene publication, unsuitable for sale or purchase. Most especially unsuitable for students of any kind, even students of medicine. I refer you to color illustrations on pages 16 and 17 and throughout chapter 4. And,
he paused dramatically,
it was printed in London.
Judge Stewart's brows lowered.
Is there a law that forbids importing medical texts from England? There is most definitely a law that forbids sending obscene materials through the mails. And if this book was printed in England, it had to get here somehow.
A reasonable assumption. Mr. Wall, will your client stipulate to the claim that a book printed in London was not printed here?
A low laugh ran through the room, but Clara's attorney kept a professional demeanor.
We so stipulate?
Judge Stewart turned his attention to Clara, who stood with her hands folded in front of her, her expression watchful but calm.
Dr. Garrison, did you send to England for this book?
No, sir, I did not.
Did you cause it to be mailed to you?
No, sir.
Do you know how it is that it got to this continent from that one?
Yes, I purchased it from a bookseller in London, and then I carried it in my valise.
Comstock said, what proof does she have of that assertion?
What proof do you have of yours? Stewart said. If you read the law with as much avarice as you read those books you find so offensive, you'd know that the burden of proof is on you, sir. You alone. Now sit down before I have you thrown out on your ear.
Stewart waited until Comstock had followed this order, and then he looked out over the courtroom.
There are two issues here, he said. The first has to do with the nature of the material itself. What I have here before me is a collection of medical illustrations such as might be used in teaching anatomy to students of medicine. Mr. Comstock has decided that such illustrations are not educational, but obscene. I find this a ludicrous claim. If there is any crime here, it is solely in the mind of the beholder.
Comstock jumped as if poked.
That's not for you to say.
You'll hold your tongue, Stewart said, or I swear I'll find you and have Roundsman Harrison throw you into a cell. Huffing and puffing will do you no good with me, Comstock. Now, tell me,
Have you ever been a student of medicine?
Comstock admitted that he had never studied, taught, or practiced medicine. He also agreed, reluctantly, that a doctor should be able to locate and recognize the different parts of the brain, the eye, the larynx, the arteries and tendons and muscles, and all the internal organs.
These aren't the first books or images of the human body you've impounded because you find them indecent, are they? I have seized thousands,
Comstock said, pulling the small amount of dignity he could muster around himself.
Many thousands. Once a month, they are incinerated. And in the meantime, they are stored in your office for safekeeping. Yes, there are several hundred at any one time. The forces of evil in this city know no bounds. And they are locked away, never to be seen by human eyes.
Comstock frowned elaborately.
They are seen only in as far as I must show them to the court to support charges. No other occasion to display them.
Comstock hesitated for the briefest moment.
Am I on trial here, sir? The Postmaster General of the United States isn't in my courtroom. There's a question before you, Mr. Comstock. On occasion, I am asked to speak to police officers about the work of the Society for the Suppression of Vice. The younger officers often cannot even imagine the filth waiting for them on the streets and back alleys. I sometimes use seized material as a tool in the education of professionals. You are an educator as well, as is Dr. Garrison.
Comstock's face went very still.
Mr. Comstock, if I understand you correctly, you use the materials in your possession to illustrate and instruct professionals. That is your word, professionals. You find these materials to be necessary to carry on your work. Dr. Garrison makes the same claim, and in her case, I would even agree. Do you have anything to add, Dr. Garrison?
Clara said, I do. I would like the record to show that my concern is first and always the health of my patients. My responsibilities to the women who study medicine I take just as seriously.
Stuart looked long and hard at Comstock, who had flushed to the roots of his hair. His whole body was shaking with rage. Comstock amused Stuart and many of the other men in the courtroom, but Anna was less dismissive. In him, Anna saw a man who was controlled by the most basic and childish of impulses, a man who had convinced himself that dealing out pain and humiliation was a sacred mission granted to him by a loving and discriminating God, because he had earned that right. Most of all, Comstock was a man who had just been humiliated and who would not forget or forgive. He would vent his anger on Clara if he could, and if not, on someone like her. The judge's gavel gave one sharp rap.
All charges are dismissed. Dr. Garrison, you are free to go. Court is adjourned.
Anna turned to Sophie.
Tell me about this, Mr. Campbell.
Sophie stood up but lowered her voice.
It was his wife who asked me about contraception. She was very low.
The details came to Anna right away, and with them, her voice caught, her voice gone dry.
Did you realize?
No, Sophie said, her voice low.
I had no idea he works for Comstock. Of course I had no idea. Have you already sent the pamphlet?
Yes.
Do you think his wife could be working with Comstock, too?
Comstock did make a habit of setting up elaborate traps for physicians he suspected of providing patients with information about birth control, but Sophie could not imagine that a woman in labor would have been part of such a scheme. She remembered too well how overwhelmed Mrs. Campbell had been. Desperation like that could not be feigned so easily. She shook her head. The crowd inched forward. and they went with it at a pace that threatened to bring them face to face with Comstock and his associates. The crowd shifted, and Anna found herself suddenly close enough to Mr. Campbell to see flecks of tobacco caught up in his red whiskers. At that moment, his gaze turned to her, and he stilled, as if the sight of a woman in the crowd was more than he could explain to himself. Then he saw Sophie. Anna watched his gaze shift and then focus. Without looking away, he spoke a word into Comstock's ear, and the two of them pivoted like puppets. Anna looked away, but not before her eyes met Comstock's, as calculating and distant and dark as a bird of prey. When she got back to the hospital, Anna found that her patient was just coming out of the state of unconsciousness that had made her surgery possible. Two of Anna's best medical students were with her, but the girl was confused and in pain, and she batted fitfully at the glass being held to her mouth. The other women on the ward were watching with interest, and Anna jerked the privacy curtain shut behind herself. She said, "No luck finding someone who speaks Hungarian."
"Here and gone," Naomi Greenleaf said. She talked to the patient and I took notes. She has an odd name, Aleki Dula,
Ada Wentworth finished, pronouncing the unusual name carefully.
16 years old. Her husband is a laborer on the new bridge.
There was a pause while they all looked out the window, a habit that had dug itself in over the last years as the Brooklyn Bridge neared completion. It was so improbable. Its size, the idea that anything man-made could span the expanse of the East River, that the sight of it against the sky might be taken for an illusion. And still, the newspapers claimed that this spring it would open for traffic. Ada went on.
"He brought her here and went to work for fear of losing his spot. She asked through the translator if she can still have children. We were careful to make sure she understood about the surgery. She wanted us to know she doesn't have any money, and she asked for a priest again. The translator said there's a priest who speaks Hungarian up near the foundling. She'll send word. And we got a good amount of broth into her, but as you can see, she won't take the laudanum."
The girl settled a little when Anna came to sit beside her and put a hand on her brow, damp with fever sweat. She was so young, and still in her expression, Anna saw that she had already resigned herself to one kind of death or another. Despite the exacting measures they took to achieve and maintain hygienic conditions, in a case like this, infection was very likely and might well claim her life. If it didn't, if they could save her, she would fall pregnant too soon and with the same outcome or worse. She had only one purpose in life, to bear and raise children. If she was brave and determined enough to seek out a way to avoid pregnancy despite such expectations, the law would punish her. But Anna would not resign herself to failure. Maybe the girl felt some of that, because now, when Anna held the glass to her mouth, she drank the water laced with laudanum, her expression contorting at the taste.
"This will help you sleep," Anna said quietly. "It will relieve the pain for a while and make it possible for me to examine you."
The girl shuddered as the tension left her shoulders and her pulse began to slow.
"We will do our very best for you," Anna said. "Now sleep for a while, Miss Dula. Let us do what we can for you."
Even after the longest and most strenuous days, Anna looked forward to the walk home, for the simple pleasure of movement and the chance to be alone with her thoughts. Most usually, she used this time to go over the day's cases and debate with herself the decisions she had made, but the events of the last 2 days were playing havoc with her powers of concentration. When she managed to put Comstock and his witch hunt out of her mind, Cap took his place.
Cap left only to make room for Rosa Russo and her sisters and brothers, who stuck like a burr in her mind, as persistent as the patients she had lost to typhus and smallpox, dysentery and sepsis. They made up a club, it seemed to Anna, and divided among themselves responsibility for keeping her aware of her failings. She walked down Stuyvesant Street to Astor Place and slowed down as she went by the Cooper Union, as was her habit. It felt like home to her, this place where she had spent so much of her girlhood. Before arthritis put an end to her work, Aunt Quinlan had taught classes here. Anyone with a sincere interest in the sciences, engineering, or the arts was welcome to enroll in the school Peter Cooper had founded. And Aunt Quinlan's classes in art theory, drawing, and painting were very popular. As a little girl, Anna had come along, first to sit nearby while her aunt taught, and then, as she got older, to explore. Wandering in and out of classrooms and lecture halls, she had absorbed talk about chemical reactions, architecture, light and shadow, and the golden mean. When she was sleepy, she made a nest in a deep reading chair in the faculty meeting room, and that was where Aunt Quinlan often found her. On the way home, they talked about what Anna had heard that day and how it all fit together. One February evening, when she was not quite 5 years old, Anna had gone with Aunt and Uncle Quinlan to hear a politician give a talk at the Cooper Union. The lecture hall was crowded and overheated, and no place for a fidgety child, and so she was sent out to play in the hall. And that was how she met Cap, who had not yet earned his nickname and still introduced himself as Peter. He had brought a box of tin soldiers, and he was delighted to tell Anna about every one of them. At first, Anna wondered if Peter didn't realize that there were boys' stories and girls' stories. And then she understood something about him. He made no such distinctions. It was a revelation to her, and made an instant bond between them. It would take another 5 years, 2 epidemics, draft riots, and a war before Sophie came to join them. But then she slid into place like a last puzzle piece. Together, the three of them made the Cooper Union their own, taking lessons there along with other children of the faculty, exploring classrooms and laboratories and lecture halls. At 12, they ventured out into the neighborhood, and finally, by 14, they had most of Manhattan by heart. Now, when Anna passed the main entrance, she was overcome with an almost unbearable sorrow. For Cap and Sophie, and for herself and the children they had been. Evening classes, always oversubscribed, were about to start. Anna watched small groups of students as they picked up the pace for fear of being late. Most of them were men intent on engineering classes, but there were women, too, here and there. None of them were expensively dressed, and all of them looked as though they had a long day's work behind them. Someone dropped an armload of books and crouched down to gather them together, his dark hair lit by the gas street lamps. Anna stopped, catching her breath, until he stood again and saw that he was a stranger, a man she had never seen before. Flustered, irritated with herself, she hurried on. How very silly to imagine Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte would cross her path again so soon, less than 24 hours since he had put rosebuds in her hair. She couldn't imagine how she might see him again in the wide expanse of Manhattan, as unbreachable now in her imagination as the Atlantic. Chapter 5. Despite her original intention to vaccinate the Hoboken orphans the day after she had first examined them, Anna's week had been so busy that she had had to postpone from Tuesday to Wednesday and again to Friday. Worse still, Sophie was called away to an emergency,
and so Anna would have to deal with Sister Ignatia on her own. The cab was drafty. Anna tucked her scarf more firmly into the neck of her cloak and counted herself lucky to be out of the weather. Mr. Lee's prediction had proved correct. Winter had returned and swept away every trace of spring. From her relatively dry and warm spot in the hired cab, Anna watched men walking into the wind hunched over, hands clapped tight on hats lest they be torn away. Sleet pooled in the gutters and streets and dripped off ledges, and every doorway was packed with bodies huddled together out of the wet, faces creased in some combination of discomfort and irritation and dull acceptance. In the street, vendors and delivery men vied with each other for right of way, all of them jumping out of the path of omnibuses and drays, oxen bellowing bass as if to harmonize with the screech of iron on iron. An omnibus shouldered through the intersection, the horses enveloped in the steam that rose from their broad backs. Urchins slipped through the crowds with clear purpose, alert and nimble despite the weather. They were making the best of the late storm. Twice the usual number of pockets would be emptied of wallets and watches by the end of the day. Going through Madison Square, she saw that the weather had not discouraged the beggars, who claimed spaces around the park that they defended with violence when necessary. She saw three or four who were familiar to her, but many others who weren't. A woman with a disfigured child in her arms, both of them wrapped in a dripping blanket coat. A man on crutches who wore an old and much abused uniform he was too young to have worn in the last war. Anna had a reputation among the poor who lived on the streets, the people the city government dismissed as the outdoor poor. Those who were truly destitute, she would stop and talk to for as long as time permitted. But the others, the professional beggars who made a living by faking injuries, or worse, by sending lame or injured children out to beg, knew that she would see them arrested and testify if necessary. The streets of Manhattan were overrun with the poor and the merciless both. Less than a week ago, she'd been out on these streets in a gown that bared her shoulders, with only a shawl to keep her warm, and on her way to a party that had cost $1 million or more. There was nothing predictable in this life, and very little that was fair. The cab passed St. Patrick's Cathedral and turned onto 51st, where the orphan asylum took up two entire city blocks, with a building for boys and one for girls. Between them was a convent, a fortress of stone hulking in the rain. The cab stopped in front of the girls' building, and Anna dashed for the entrance. Once inside, she took out her handkerchief to pat her face dry, and then looked around herself for the porter. Instead, she was intercepted by an ageless, humorless nun who introduced herself as Sister Peter Joseph. She reminded Anna of Sister Ignatia simply because she wore a black habit rather than a white one, in contrast to the younger Sister Mary Augustine. Sister Peter Joseph's spine had begun to curve with old age, but she moved as quickly as a girl, gesturing to a young woman in yet another habit, this one gray, who came to take Anna's coat and scarf and hat to be whisked away to a cloakroom, she supposed, well out of sight. Anna followed the old nun down hallways, her boots slipping a little as they rounded corners on the highly polished floors. They stopped in front of a door with two words printed across it, Mother Superior. Anna said, "Is there some problem?" Instead of answering, Sister Peter Joseph opened the door and gestured Anna inside, followed her, and then adjusted the skirts of her habit as she took the chair behind the desk. Anna was a little amused to realize she had assumed that Sister Ignatia was the head of the orphanage. She was glad she had been mistaken. "I first want to thank you for the interest you took in the welfare of our charges," Sister Peter Joseph began, As you are aware, Sister Ignatia does not approve of vaccinations. She believes they are dangerous.
Yes, I gathered.
Nevertheless, it is our policy to vaccinate, and I was surprised and displeased to learn that this had been neglected. I have had more than a few surprises this week, at any rate. The children, all of them, have been vaccinated against smallpox. This was done by staff from St. Vincent's Hospital over the last 2 days. She took a folder out of a drawer and pushed it across the desk to Anna. The vaccination records, if you would like to examine them. Anna didn't open the folder, and she didn't try to hide her irritation.
If everyone has been vaccinated, you might have sent me a message.
And spared you the trip in such unpleasant weather. Yes, I might have. But I am hoping that now you are here, you would be willing to examine some of the sisters.
You don't have a physician who visits regularly?
Eyes the color of autumn oak leaves assessed her coolly.
Am I asking too much?
Anna felt herself flush.
I would be happy to be of assistance.
Another folder appeared and was pushed across the desk. These are the records for the sisters who need to be seen. There are 2 novice nursing sisters waiting for you in the infirmary to assist. If there is something you need that you don't find, send one of them to me and I will see what can be done. The convent infirmary is at the end of this hall, then to the left. It's clearly marked. At the door, Anna hesitated.
Is Sister Mary Augustine available this afternoon? I was hoping to speak to her.
There was a long pause, as well as a new set of furrows between the sparse white eyebrows.
Or do I ask too much?
Anna finished. She had earned herself an amused smile. I will send her to you before you leave. The infirmary was a large rectangular space, as clean as any treatment room at the New Amsterdam. Along one wall were supply cabinets, a table for the preparation of medicines, a tall glass-fronted case of instruments, sterilization equipment, and a deep sink. A pair of examination tables took up the middle of the room, each surrounded by a privacy curtain that could be pulled closed. She had a moment to wonder whether the children's infirmary was as well equipped. And then she chided herself for assuming the worst. Her first patient was a nun about 30 years old with a sprained wrist. After that, she treated an eye infection, lanced a boil, wrote out a receipt for a liniment that would loosen stiff joints, and finally diagnosed what was almost certainly the start of tubercular kidney and would need to be closely monitored. She wrote her observations and advice on a sheet of paper left in each nun's folder and hoped they would be read. The sisters were all quiet and cooperative and utterly stoic. They asked no questions but answered the ones she put to them without hesitation. It was all very routine until a 52-year-old Sister Frances Xavier introduced herself as the orphanage and convent procuratrix. At Anna's blank expression, she explained.
Food, she said. Drink. I'm the one who makes sure there's enough to feed all these little faces. Like birdies in the nest, they are, always peeping and opening their mouths wide enough to see right down their pink gullets. And the sisters, too.
She patted an ample belly.
I like my work.
Sister Xavier had a mass in her breast the size of an apple. As Anna palpated it, the sister asked,
Do you think I'd get a blue ribbon at the state fair? Hurts like the devil. Waxes and wanes like the moon.
How long has this been with you?
The smooth brow creased as she thought.
20 years, maybe? Seems to me if it was the cancer, it would have killed me long ago. But now it's got so big it throbs like a rotten tooth.
Can it be got rid of?
It can, Anna said. Or at least, I can do a needle aspiration today and then remove it for you surgically sometime soon. With any luck, it won't come back again after that. You'll have to come to the hospital for the procedure.
Hospital?
Xavier huffed a laugh.
Not me. You can draw it out with a needle, didn't you say? That will do.
I can drain it for you here, but that will only give you relief for a short time. Surgery is called for. I'll talk to your mother superior about it, unless you'd rather someone else operated. Sister Xavier scowled at the ceiling in a way that made Anna feel sympathy for the sisters who worked under her in the kitchens. She puffed out an irritated explosion of breath.
If it must be done, better you than one of the doctors at St. Vincent's. I don't care to let a man take a knife to me.
Good, Anna said. For the moment, let's see what we can do to give you some relief. It will take me a few minutes to get a sense of the mass, and then I have to sterilize my instruments and the operating field. The aspiration itself will take less than a minute.
Endless bother, Xavier said. Get on with it.
But while Anna worked, Sister Frances Xavier couldn't keep quiet. She talked and asked questions, but never lost sight of what Anna was doing, stopping her now and then. What was in that bottle? And could she smell it? And if the hypodermic needle had been used on someone else before, and how it was cleaned? Where the others had been adamantly silent, she was determined to fill the room with words. It was an opportunity Anna could not ignore, this nun who was so willing to talk. I wanted to ask about some Italian children who came in from Hoboken this past Monday, orphaned in a smallpox epidemic. Two boys, two girls. Russo is the family name. Would you know anything about them? She got a partial shrug as a reply.
Monday is as good as a month around here, and the boys would be in the other building if they're still here at all.
That gave Anna pause, but she focused on what seemed nearer to hand. And the girls? Sister Xavier said.
There's talk of sisters coming over from Italy to start an orphanage for their own, but in the meantime, the Guinea girls are usually sent down to the old place.
She used the word Guinea, a terrible insult, even Anna was aware of that much, as easily as she might have said house or child. It took Anna's breath away for a moment, and then she steadied. There will be a pinch now, but please hold still. And then, and here it is. Sister Frances Xavier let out a great sigh as Anna pulled back on the plunger and a cloudy yellow liquid filled the syringe.
That's better already.
While Anna cleaned the puncture site and bandaged it, she considered how best to ask what she needed to know.
You're as bad as the novitiates,
Sister Xavier said, her tone grumpier by the minute.
Can't spit out whatever it is you need to say.
I don't know what you mean by the old place. Where is that? Sister Xavier sat up with some trouble.
This is the new St. Patrick's, the cathedral buildings. The old place got too crowded, you see, and so the bishop got after the mayor until he gifted this land for a bigger orphan asylum.
But the older asylum is still in use?
It is. The Italian girls are more likely to be sent there.
And why is that? The shoulder under the black habit lifted in a shrug.
They're more at home down there on Mott Street, among their own kind.
It was 6 by the time Anna finished with the last examination. She found her own way back along the corridors, past darkened offices and classrooms. Somewhere in another part of the building, bells chimed. But otherwise, the halls were far too quiet to house hundreds of little girls. Little girls who learned their letters and their prayers and how to polish wooden floors along with other harder lessons. At the next window, She paused to look out and saw the reason for the quiet. Two lines of girls were walking, quick step, along a well-traveled path to one of the cathedral's side entrances. Apparently, evening prayer services were in order. She wondered how many times a day this process repeated itself, and whether the girls minded. She thought probably not. They wore sturdy shoes and hooded capes, and their bellies were full. Some of them had probably put up with much worse for far less. Anna was dry and warm now, but her stomach growled, and she wanted tea and a sandwich and a place to sit quietly for a few moments before she went back out into the weather. There was no sign of the young sister who had taken her wraps to the cloakroom, but Anna found them, neatly folded, on a chair in the empty hall. It seemed that Sister Mary Augustine was not available after all. For a long moment, Anna waited, standing beside a window to watch as a spring rain replaced the sleet. She would have to go hunt down a cab. The thought was still in her head when she felt a light touch on her elbow.
"Pardon me," said Sister Mary Augustine. "I didn't mean to startle you, but I'm so glad I caught you before you left."
They sat on the visitor's bench in the little lobby as the light rain gave way to watery sunshine, light falling in stripes to make a checkerboard on the cool gray stone floor.
"Mother Superior gave me permission to talk to you," Sister Mary Augustine said. "But I don't have long, and there are things you should know," she swallowed, visibly, "about the Russo children."
"You sought me out to give me bad news, I take it." Many emotions moved over the younger woman's face. Fear, regret, guilt all came and went. But finally she nodded and the story came out quite quickly. She told Anna about the drunken brawl on the docks and the rush back to the orphan asylum. Somehow, she said, the boys had gotten separated from the rest of the children.
"Separated? They never arrived here."
Anna sat back, and Mary Augustine went on. They had instituted a search once this was discovered, but without success. The boys had last been seen 4 days ago on Monday. Rosa was beside herself with worry. Anna offered to talk to the girl, and color rose in Mary Augustine's face.
"They're gone," she said. "They were transferred to the old St. Patrick's on Wednesday. The priest there is Italian."
She offered this as if it were explanation enough. And in fact, it did lend credence to what Sister Ignatia had told her. Most Italians and Irish lived in the tenements crowded together along the East River.
"All right," Anna said. "I'll go there straight away and talk to them."
She was very tired, but she would not sleep if she let this stand while Rosa waited for word.
"That's the trouble," Sister Mary Augustine said, her voice taking on a bit of a wobble. "You won't find them."
"I think I can find a Catholic orphan asylum on Mott Street."
"No doubt," Sister Mary Augustine said. "But they aren't there anymore. Sometime after 11 at night and 6 in the morning, they went out into the weather and disappeared. The whole area was combed multiple times, but there's no trace of them."
Struck silent by surprise, Anna asked herself why Rosa would do such a desperate thing. Were the girls punished or treated badly? Mary Augustine looked as though she had been anticipating this question.
"I don't know. My guess is that Rosa wouldn't stop asking about her brothers, and one of the sisters lost her temper and was harsh."
"Harsh," Anna echoed. "And you have no idea where they might be. So now all four children are missing."
"Yes," Mary Augustine said. "I'm afraid so."
Anna, at a loss for words, stared for a full minute. "Then we'll have to find them. Immediately." Supper break,
and Jack sat at his desk in the detective squad room, watching Oscar pace back and forth, grumpier with every step. He was so hungry and required feeding, and soon Jack would have to get up and go out into the weather or simply resign himself to Oscar's mood. "You'd think you'd never got wet before in your life," Oscar muttered, and, "Now we're in for it." A runner had appeared at the door waving an assignment sheet. On Washington Square, a patrolman had come across Italian trespassers on university grounds who wouldn't be shifted. He had called his roundsman, who was requesting a translator.
"I'll miss supper,"
Oscar groused. With a pointed look at Maroni's middle, Jack grabbed his overcoat and hat and headed for the door. The wet snow gave way quite suddenly to a warmer and gentler wind, and with that, the feel of spring had come back into the air. In Washington Square Park, Jack felt the subtle stir of things growing, as tangible as sunlight on the skin. New York University sat across from the northeast corner of the park, more like a church with its tall arches and spires, to Jack's mind, except for the noise that a crowd of undergraduates were making trying to get a game of baseball going in the park. They'd be covered in muck and mud in no time, but Jack understood the urge to be moving. Oscar did too, from the looks he threw in the direction of the players. He would join in with very little encouragement. They entered the university through the main doors and heard the argument from across the foyer. The porter's desk was empty, but the door behind it was open and provided a view of Harry Pettigrew facing off with a small woman who stood close, her face turned up at a sharp angle to scold the roundsman, the traditional posture of mothers with sons twice their size and a bone to pick.
"It's Harry who's needing rescuing, so it seems," Oscar said. "That's the porter's wife, got him backed into a corner."
It wasn't until he stepped into the office that Jack caught sight of the two little girls who sat side by side on the counter.
So, not intruders, after all, not even street children.
These two were too fragile to survive on the street, and so, Jack reasoned to himself, they had run away or been put out. One of them was crying softly, while the other sat stony-faced, her arm around the smaller girl.
"Mrs. Conway," Pettigrew was saying, "no one means these girls any harm."
"So say you."
"Hold on, Mrs. Conway," Oscar said. "Don't be in such a rush to draw and quarter the poor roundsman."
While Oscar negotiated a peace between the parties, Jack got a better look at the two children. They were both dripping wet and filthy, hair straggling over threadbare clothes. They shivered with the cold despite the towels that had been wrapped around them and the coal heaped up in the stove. The older of the two raised her head to look at him directly, and in that moment Jack recognized her. Rosa, if he remembered correctly. The last he had seen of her was getting off the Hoboken ferry, her brothers and sister gathered in close. She had been determined to keep the little family together, and she had clearly failed, as he had known she must. Now the last name came to him as well, Rosa Russo. She recognized him, too, because her expression shifted to puzzlement and then, quite quickly, relief. Jack remembered that she had been proud of her English, and he started with that.
"Miss Russo," he said. "We meet again."
The argument stopped abruptly as Roundsman Pettigrew, the porter's wife, the porter, and the patrolman turned to look at Jack. Pettigrew regained his composure first.
"She doesn't speak English." "Of course she does. Don't you, Rosa?"
Jack said, keeping his gaze on her. The girl drew herself up with great dignity, a small queen finally recognized by one of her subjects.
"Yes," she said, "I am an American."
"Hoboken," Jack said to Oscar.
enough to clue him in on the circumstances without divulging information to the porter or his wife. Jack said,
"Why didn't you tell these good people that you speak English?"
"It would not have mattered," she said, looking at the adults. "They won't listen to me no matter what language I speak. And I knew if I told them what they wanted to know," she frowned at Pettigrew, "they would send us back to—"
She took note of the way Pettigrew leaned toward her and paused. In Italian, she said,
"Il orfano troppo. It took us long enough to get this far, and Leah is very tired."
"You ran away."
Oscar spoke his Neapolitan Italian, very similar to the language the girls spoke. Rosa glanced at him nervously, taken aback by the combination of an Irish face and the language of her home. Finally, she nodded. With patient questioning, Oscar was able to pinpoint where the girls had started and when. They had left the orphan asylum at Prince and Mott before light and started north, asking directions from an Italian street musician with a monkey who wore a hat.
"But how did you ask for directions? Where is it you're trying to go?"
"Here," Rosa said, spreading out her arms. "Sister Mary Augustine described this place exactly."
Sister Mary Augustine from St. Patrick's. The face came back to him quickly, but he was missing something, so he thought for a moment and phrased his question carefully.
"Sister Mary Augustine told you how to get here, to this place?"
"No,"
Rosa said, irritation starting to rise again.
"On the journey from the ferry,"
she stopped herself.
"On the way to that place, the omnibus went past this church that isn't a church after all. Sister Mary Augustine pointed to it and told us that Dr. Savard lived just nearby. She told us about the house that has a garden bigger than its own self behind a brick wall, and fruit trees, and a pergola, and hens and a rooster."
"Un gallo,"
her sister echoed, as if a rooster could only exist in Italian.
"I was sure I could find it because Dr. Savard has to help us. They took our brothers away, and I have to find them. I was so sure I could find a house with angels over the door," she finished.
To Leah, Oscar said,
"Angeli sopra la porta."
"Sì, putti e gigli."
It struck Jack that the little girl was trying very hard to be exact. He turned to Pettigrew.
"Is there a house nearby with lilies and angels carved above the door?" "More likely cherubs or cupids," Oscar suggested.
"Cupids,"
Leah mimicked.
"Carved into the stone lintel. Does that sound familiar?" "It's Mrs. Quinlan they want," the patrol officer said. "If they had said about the angels and lilies before, we would have solved this right away. The Quinlan place is half a block away."
At that, Rosa's composure finally cracked, and tears began to leak down her face. There was something very formal about her, even in her despair. But the little one was less bound by pride. Leah might not have understood the exchange, but her sister's tears were more than she could bear. When Oscar held out his arms, Leah collapsed toward him, pushed her face into the wool of his coat, and sobbed openly.
"She could have told us she was looking for the Quinlan place," Pettigrew said to Jack, gruff embarrassment in his tone. "Everybody knows the house with the walled garden. All they had to do was speak English."
Cousin Margaret was reading aloud to them from the paper, something she liked to do because, Sophie understood, it was the only way to introduce the subjects she wanted to discuss. Margaret, raised in this house by Uncle Quinlan and his first wife, had only a few interests. Her sons, the way she was perceived by the other old Knickerbocker families, keeping the memory of her husband alive, and crime. She read many papers every day and kept a ledger detailing all the crimes that happened within a square mile of home. Now, she sat in an elegant but understated day dress, her posture perfect, her head held erect,
and read to them about a burglary on Green Street, just 2 blocks away, in that neighborhood she referred to as Frenchtown. If she went on any longer in that tone, there would be an argument. Aunt Quinlan could tolerate only so much of Margaret's fear-mongering, and even less of her distaste for immigrants. Eventually, she would be compelled to remind her stepdaughter that her father's grandparents had been immigrants. It was an old and exhausting argument, and Sophie was thinking of ways to deflect it when she saw 2 men coming up the street. The older of the two, carrying a very little girl in a ragged coat far too big for her. A second girl of 8 or 9 years was looking up at the houses as they passed, pointing to gates and lampposts and doorways and explaining something. The girls looked as though they had been living on the street and had had a hard time of it. Margaret said,
"Sophie, have you lost your hearing? I was asking..."
The strangers had stopped and were looking at Aunt Quinlan's door with its frieze of angels and lilies.
"We have company," Sophie said.
Aunt Quinlan sat up, cheered as she always was at the arrival of visitors. "And still no sign of Anna. I wonder if Sister Ignatia has taken her hostage. Maybe we should send Mr. Lee with a ransom."
Jack couldn't quite believe that Anna Savard might actually live in this particular house. But there was the door with angels and lilies, finely carved along the stone lintel. He had gone down this street hundreds of times, and always he had wondered about this substantial limestone house of 4 stories, with mature pear and plum trees visible over the garden wall.
"Do you know that lady?"
Oscar pointed with his chin to the window where a young woman stood. Jack didn't recognize her, and neither did Rosa, whose whole face collapsed.
"No," she said, "that's not Dr. Savard, but the angels and the lilies."
"Remember, Sergeant Pettigrew said there were 2 ladies named Savard living here."
There was no sign of Maroney's legendary impatience and volatility. He had been tamed by a little girl with a dirty face. The door opened. The woman standing there was not Anna Savard, though she had the same bearing and the air of confidence. This woman's features were fuller, and her eyes were a color he couldn't name. Not green or blue, but somewhere in between, just as her skin was somewhere between old honey and copper. While these thoughts went through Jack's head, Oscar was dealing with introductions and explaining what had brought them to her door on a spring evening. Jack heard the words Hoboken and Orphan and Sister Mary Augustine. As it turned out, this was also a Dr. Savard, another female physician. Jack had gone most of his life without ever encountering such a creature, and now they seemed to be everywhere. Rosa was saying,
"Is the other Dr. Savard here? Can we see her, please?"
This Dr. Savard had a kind smile, one that would put a child's worries to rest.
"She isn't here right now, but we expect her any moment. Would you like to come in and wait for her?"
And then her gaze shifted, first to Oscar and then Jack.
"Detective sergeants, please do come in."
She introduced them all to another woman, this one called Margaret Cooper. Middle-aged, a little nervous in disposition, a war widow if Jack was any judge, and to the older lady, Mrs. Quinlan.
"I sense a mystery and it's unraveling all at once," Mrs. Quinlan said. "Very exciting. Come in and sit down. Mrs. Lee, we will have guests for supper once Anna is come, but right now we're in dire need of tea."
The parlor was large and comfortable, but Jack felt as though he had stepped unawares into a train that was gathering speed. Odder still, he was too curious to even think about getting off. Instead, he watched as the Russo girls were stripped of their wraps and swaddled in blankets, to sit together in an upholstered chair close to the hearth. They were telling their story to the three women, Rosa in English with commentary from Leah in Italian. Little by little, Rosa's hectic tone quieted, and she began to hiccup between sentences. Quick, sharp gulps of air. A little girl, after all, ready to hand over her burdens to these women, who listened so closely with such serious expressions. Looking at her now, it was hard to believe she had dared so much and survived. In Jack's experience, most men gave children little thought. They were distractions to be ignored, or resources to be trained and put to work, or burdens to be fed and clothed, and often all three at once. As a police officer, Jack had come to understand that the children in circumstances such as these required more, demanded more than willful ignorance or benign disregard. Rosa was terrified, angry, confused, despairing. But at the same time, she distinguished herself by an iron force of will. There was a simple, undeniable fact she would make these women understand. Her brothers must be returned to her. Their father had deserted them, but Rosa would not. Jack let his gaze wander over the room, full of color and well lit by gaslight from crystal wall sconces and hanging lamps. Paintings and drawings crowded the walls, and overhead, a mural in jewel-like colors spread over the entire ceiling. There were tall bookcases filled to overflowing behind glass fronts. A basket of needlework set aside, plants in tiled pots, shiny-leafed and vigorous. It was an unusual room in an unusual house, peopled by women who seemed unshakable, who took the appearance of wet Italian orphans and police detectives at their door as nothing out of the ordinary. His sisters would look around this room, at the clothing and draperies and tablecloth, and tell him what it all meant. They might be affronted or charmed. On a side table in a prominent spot, a dozen framed photos were grouped together. He counted 8 men in uniform, the youngest no more than 18. On a cabinet card, elaborately framed, was a man of at least 70.
"That is my father,"
Margaret Cooper said, coming up behind him. Jack realized just then that she stood out from the others, primarily because of her clothing, quite fashionable and conservative, which meant that she was trussed like a leg of lamb bound for the oven.
"Did he return to active duty for the war?"
She smiled, happy to have him open the conversation. "He was an army surgeon, retired. The next photograph is my brother James. Aunt Quinlan, as Sophie and Anna call her, is my stepmother."
"The other men?" he asked.
She pointed to each face in turn, her finger hovering but not touching. "This is Andrew, my husband. He fell at Chickamauga. This is Nathaniel Ballantyne, Aunt Quinlan's son by her first husband. He died at Shiloh, fighting beside my brother. Nathaniel and James went to school together. They were the best of friends. These 5, her finger skimmed, are some of my stepmother's nephews. None of these men came home. Not one." Oscar had been standing aside but paying attention. Now he made a soft sound in his throat.
"I'm sorry to hear it. My sincere condolences."
Jack glanced at Mrs. Quinlan, still deep in conversation with the little girls, and then returned to the collection of cabinet cards. A wedding party. A fat little boy standing with one hand wound in the coat of a huge dog. 2 young blonde women so much alike that they had to be twins. A small painting on an easel showed an Indian woman with high cheekbones, her hair threaded with white. She was laughing, her arms wrapped around herself. Oscar touched his shoulder and inclined his head to a portrait that hung on the opposite wall.
There were dozens of photographs and paintings of President Lincoln that appeared every so often in newspapers and magazines. But Jack couldn't remember ever seeing an oil portrait, one in which the man came to life.
"That is my stepmother's work," Margaret Cooper said. "Mrs. Quinlan is well regarded as an artist, or was, before arthritis put an end to it all."
It was hard to fathom at that moment. The old lady who spoke so kindly to the little girls had been beautiful as a young woman. That was still clear. But she had also been capable of painting like this. President Lincoln, as Jack liked to think of him, alive, sharp energy in the dark eyes. Everyone had their own memories of the day of the assassination, stories that had been told again and again, and would be told today and tomorrow and all the days of their lives. The conversation could start up among strangers in a train car or at Sunday dinner. Jack's attention moved to a photograph of two young girls and a boy of 10 or 11. After a moment's study, he realized one of the girls was Sophie Savard and the other was Anna. He supposed the boy might be Cap Verhoeven, with a mop of blonde hair and a grin of the kind so rare in photographs. Oscar said, "It looks as though they grew up together like brother and sisters."
"Not quite."
Sophie had come to help the housekeeper with a tea cart.
"I was 10 when Aunt Quinlan sent for me, as soon as it was safe to travel after the war. Listen," she said, turning. "She is so pleased to have the chance to speak Italian. See how her face lights up."
The old lady's language was quite formal, and by listening to it, Jack knew that she had traveled or lived in Italy long ago and learned from tutors who placed more value on formal grammar than conversation. But still, she had an ear for the language. She must have felt him looking, because she raised her head and smiled at him and took his breath away. Beautiful as a young woman, yes. The beauty had gone with the years, but left something just as powerful behind. And just then, Jack heard the sound of the front door opening and closing, and then she was there. Liliane called Anna. Her color was high, but Jack had the idea that it was agitation rather than the weather at fault. Standing in the doorway, she pulled her hat off and her scarf away to reveal the tripling pulse at the base of her throat. She had caught sight of the Russo girls and moved forward without pausing, dropping her things as she went. The others were talking to her all at once, but Anna seemed not to hear them. She made a visible effort to straighten her back and steady her expression, but it was clear that she was shaken.
"I see we have company," she said, her voice a little rough.
"Indeed," said Mrs. Quinlan. "You've met Rosa and Leah, I believe."
The girls were leaning forward, as interested in Anna as she was in them.
"We met in Hoboken, yes," Anna said. "In fact, I was about to go out searching for the two of you. You have entire convents up in arms."
She crouched down in front of the girls and touched them lightly, heads, faces, shoulders. Her aunt said,
"We have other guests, Anna."
She nodded toward the alcove where Jack and Oscar stood. Anna pivoted, her expression suddenly guarded. Jack tried to smile and found himself able to muster no more than a twitch at the corner of his mouth.
"Good evening," Oscar said, clearly enjoying both the situation and Jack's carefully masked interest. "Dr. Savard, I hope you will forgive the intrusion."
A new wash of color rose along her throat and crept into her face, only to fall away just as rapidly to leave behind mottling, something Jack had seen only rarely in his life, on the faces and throats and breasts of the few women he had taken to his bed. The image took him by surprise.
and made him turn his face to hide his own expression, which he feared would give away as much as a woman's blush. Oscar was talking about Pettigrew, the children in the porter's office at the university, how they had come to find the house. Jack heard only bits of this. He was so flustered by the workings of his own mind. Then he turned his head and saw that Anna Savard was watching him. For a split second, he had the idea that she had read his thoughts and seen a picture of herself, stripped bare, in his embrace, breathless. She smiled, a half smile, a weary but welcoming smile, such as she might give anyone.
Rosa, she said, you must promise me never to run away again. They lost my brothers, Rosa said with great calm, and they don't care.
Nothing was done out of malice, Anna said, and seeing the girl's confusion, they did not set out to cause you harm.
But harm was done.
Such presence of mind in such a young girl, Rosa said.
You won't send us back, will you?
And there was the question. Before anyone could respond, Margaret Cooper stood abruptly.
Of course not, she said in a tone that brooked no discussion. What these little girls need is a warm bath and a good meal, and then a bed piled high with pillows and blankets and comforters where they can sleep through the night without fear, where they can sleep as long as they like, and then have a large and filling breakfast.
The most maternal of the group, then. The younger Savard women seemed satisfied to have their cousin take the little girls in hand. Leah, Biddable, came off her chair with a thump, trailing blankets. Even Rosa got to her feet without question, her face slack with weariness, now that she had finally reached her goal. They were going into the dining room before Anna had time to make any sense of the situation or her own state of mind, or minds, because she seemed to have more than one. She was exhausted and exhilarated, angry, and in the grip of an almost preternatural calm, agitated and focused. Part of that had to do with the turmoil of questions that had occupied her during the cab ride home. How to best search for the missing girls? If there were friends who could be called in to help, or if that would further complicate an already fraught situation? If the police should be notified, and why the Sisters of Charity had not done so already? If it would be sound reasoning to start by inquiring at hospitals? All of these questions and more. And underlying all of this, a dread that sat heavy. Had she shown even minimal interest instead of just walking away from the ferry, this whole situation might have been avoided. She should have done something. Anything. All of that, only to be relieved of the burden by the simple act of coming home to find the girls in her own parlor. The sight of them, safe, had worked like cold water on a hot afternoon. And then she had turned to find Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte looking at her, just when she had resigned herself to forgetting him. He was still looking, sitting across from her at the table in her own home, quiet and observant as his partner told the story in more detail. Now that the little girls were out of the room, they talked more openly about the things that might have gone wrong but didn't. Anna applied herself to her food with such focus that it took a moment to realize that someone had asked her a question. Mrs. Lee stood beside her with the soup tureen, one brow raised and a quirk to her mouth that did not bode well. Nothing escaped Mrs. Lee. There would be questions, but Anna would not give her answers because a lie would be sniffed out immediately, and the truth was too tender to be handled. Aunt Quinlan said,
Anna, did you mention Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte when you told us about your trip to Hoboken on Easter Monday?
She mentioned him to me, Sophie said. You translated for Anna. Isn't that right, Detective Sergeant?
Anna knew that Sophie was willing to intervene on her behalf,
but it was too much to ask, and moreover, doomed to failure. They would not be distracted, these old women to whom she belonged, heart and soul. She took hold of the conversation.
Sister Mary Augustine wasn't quite up to the challenge of so many dialects, Anna said. The priest was away at...
She looked at Jack Mezzanotte directly.
The term escapes me.
Extreme unction, he supplied. Last rites.
So I was very glad of his help. But I first met Detective Sergeant Maroney at the Vanderbilt's masked ball later that evening, she added. They were there on duty.
Sophie had been participating in the conversation with her usual good manners, but now she stiffened slightly.
To Detective Maroney, she said, Did you meet our friend Cap?
We didn't have the pleasure, he answered. I was sorry to learn that he is so ill.
It was phrased in a way that could be taken as a question or an observation. He is consumptive, Aunt Quinlan said.
Anna was glad of the change in topic, but it also confused her. It wasn't like Aunt Quinlan to talk to strangers about Cap's health. Something else was going on.
She was saying, Sophie has had a letter from a specialist in Switzerland.
She raised a brow in Anna's direction.
We plan to tell you about it this evening.
Hmm, Anna said doubtfully. She wondered when exactly this letter had arrived. More important, she understood that she had been outmaneuvered. The subject of the letter had been brought up because the company at the table would force her to be patient and keep what would otherwise be sharp questions to herself. For the time being.
A specialist who can cure consumption? Oscar Maroney looked both impressed and doubtful.
No, Sophie said. Not yet, but he is opening a clinic, too small to be called a sanatorium, really, to launch a trial for a new therapy.
Anna said.
We'll have to go over the details later. That is, if Cap indicates an interest. And there, she thought, that should be enough to end the conversation, both at this table and at any other time. Cap would have nothing to do with such a scheme. Except now Aunt Quinlan was looking at her thoughtfully, with something in her expression Anna didn't like at all.
But he is interested, her aunt said. He asked for you to come by on Sunday to discuss it.
Jack had been watching the back and forth between the older women and the younger ones, seeing affection and respect in the way they talked to each other, but also challenges and long-held disagreements.
So may I ask, what do you plan to do about the Russo girls?
All eyes turned to him.
Would you like us to take them back to the asylum?
Beside him, Maroney moved uneasily.
You would do that?
Sophie seemed genuinely surprised.
If you asked us to, we would have to take them.
Where?
Aunt Quinlan wanted to know.
To Mott Street.
Margaret Cooper appeared in the doorway as if her name had been called.
You cannot be serious. We can't send them back there, she said. Not in good conscience.
Margaret, Anna began, but her cousin had already walked away, her back stiff and straight.
She wants to take them in?
Oscar looked at each of the women in turn, one brow raised in polite surprise.
She is very maternal and misses having children to look after, but of course this is something we need to think about and discuss at length before we undertake something so important,
Mrs. Quinlan said. Then Margaret was back, a newspaper in her hands.
Chinese opium den raided, she read aloud. Young girls living in the neighborhood have been decoyed for immoral purposes.
Her eyes scanned the page.
A brawl outside Mayor's Tavern at Cherry and Water Streets ended in a fatal stabbing. And oh yes, this. The body of a young boy found in an outhouse on Prince Street. Marks of violence. Shall I go on?
Oscar was clearly surprised and delighted at this unexpected source of information.
You subscribe to the Police Gazette?
I do, she said, as if she had been challenged. The old aunt shook her head.
Margaret, we are all aware of the dangers in that neighborhood, but that's not the issue just now. We have to send word to the sisters that they can stop searching. It doesn't mean we'll send the girls away.
We might not have a choice, Sophie said. The church will have an opinion.
Margaret Cooper's expression turned sour, but Anna got up from the table before the conversation could continue.
I'll write that note now.
Once the detective sergeants had gone off to the convent with the note and a message, Anna let herself be drawn into a fraught conversation about the little girls and what it would mean to keep them.
These are not stray cats,
she said aloud to no one in particular, and with that sparked a sputtering maternal declaration from Margaret. She, Margaret Quinlan Cooper, knew far better than Anna what it meant to raise children, the responsibilities, the work and effort and potential for heartbreak. If Anna didn't like the idea of being tied down, well then Anna should just continue as she was and leave the poor girls to others who knew the business best. Margaret's two boys were evidence enough that she was equal to the task. Margaret glanced at Aunt Quinlan as she came to the end of this speech, but didn't get the agreement she sought. Instead, Aunt Quinlan said,
Margaret, do you sincerely want to dedicate the next 20 years to the raising of these two children?
And the two brothers, if we should find them? Sophie said quietly.
Are we looking for them? Her aunt asked.
Anna forced herself to take 3 deep breaths. She knew what she needed to say, but not exactly why she needed to say it.
I will look for them, she began slowly. I intend to find them, if that is possible. I feel as though I owe Rosa that much, and please don't ask me to explain myself because I'm not sure I can.
That's quite clear, Anna, her aunt said. She reminds you of yourself.
Flushed with irritation, Anna said, My situation was nothing like hers. I had family. There was never any uncertainty about who would look after me. She didn't like the look on her aunt's face, and so she went on. Even if the girls go back to the orphan asylum, I will make an effort to locate the boys.
The chances of finding them are very small, her aunt said gently.
Sophie said,
But if we should somehow find them, we'd have 4 young children on our hands.
Her expression was calm, but her tone was unmistakable. She would support Anna in her decision, but first she would be sure that the decision was not made rashly.
Whatever we decide to do, we have to tell the girls in the morning,
Aunt Quinlan said.
The uncertainty is too much for them.
It was another 1.5 hours before they had come to any kind of consensus, and still Anna lay awake once she finally found herself in bed. She got up and lit her desk lamp, got out paper and pen and inkpot. She had gone over the wording so many times in her head, she wrote quickly and without pause. Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte, I write to thank you for your kind assistance to the Russo girls and for bringing them to us. After long discussion, we have decided to ask the Sisters of Charity to give us custody of the girls while we apply for guardianship status. We will take full responsibility for them and agree to raise them as Catholics should that be required. If you are willing, we would like permission to use your name as a reference in writing our petition to the church authorities. Please let us know if this is acceptable to you. We will also commit to taking in the 2 Russo boys, should we have success finding them. I recognize the difficulty of such an undertaking, but I feel an obligation to at least try. Thank you once again for your understanding and kindness. Sincerely yours, Anna Savard. 1/2 hour later, almost asleep, Anna sat up suddenly in bed. The first shimmer of dawn was in the sky, but she lit the lamp once again, because she had made an error to be corrected. She began the letter once again. Detective Sergeants Mezzanotte and Maroni. The next morning, Anna sat across from Sophie at the kitchen table, studying a letter that had come with the first mail delivery. It was very brief, and, unfortunately, not the first of its kind. Dear Dr. Savard, I know a number of ladies who have been treated by you, and who speak of your wide knowledge and consummate skill as a physician specializing in women's health. Today, I write in the hope that you might be able to provide me with that particular kind of sensitive information the mother of many children must sometimes have. I have recently seen one such pamphlet, which I believe you supplied a friend, and I would gladly pay for my own copy. Indeed, I would like to buy any pamphlets you have on the restoration of menses and good health. Please write to me at Herald Square, Post Box 886, with a list of available pamphlets and their cost. Thank you in advance for your kind assistance. Yours most sincerely, Mrs. C.J. Latimer. On the table between them was also a larger sheet of paper with a single line of writing at the top. Latimer equals Campbell. It was the way she and Sophie and Cap had always tackled a difficult problem in geometry or chemistry. She and Sophie continued the practice at college and in medical school, studying pharmacology and physiology. And now they sometimes discussed a difficult case. The letter from the lady signing herself Mrs. Latimer was nothing out of the ordinary, but it had roused Sophie's suspicions. Given the timing, she feared it was connected to the pamphlet she had sent Mrs. Campbell. If her husband had intercepted the envelope, this could be a trap, yet another effort to manipulate her into violating the Comstock Act. At Sophie's elbow was a pile of newspaper clippings that dated back 5 years, all of which had to do with Comstock's arrest of physicians, midwives, printers, and druggists for distribution of contraceptives or information about contraceptives. There was a handwritten chart attached, on which Anna had calculated the number of arrests according to the type of evidence and the outcome of the case. Comstock was not terribly successful in prosecuting these cases, but he was persistent, and sometimes with the right judge, he got what he wanted. She recognized in herself a kind of compulsion to keep track of Comstock, and a general irritation that such a thing should be necessary. For all they knew, other physicians all over the city were just as worried about the possibility of being entrapped, but they were also afraid of Comstock that they didn't raise the subject in company. "We don't have enough information," Anna said when they had been going over the facts available to them for 10 minutes. "I don't see any real connection to Mrs. Campbell." "Maybe not, but I think we have to assume the worst," Sophie said. "Mrs. Campbell would have received the pamphlet I sent on Wednesday, probably in the first mail delivery of the day. It was 2 days after I attended her delivery, and 1 day after her husband looked at me, directly at me, while he stood next to Comstock, at Clara Garrison's trial. We have to warn the printer," she said. "If the pamphlet was traced to me, it could be traced to him, and I will not take that chance." "Think about it for one more day," Anna said. "And think about this, too. If Comstock does have someone watching you, that person could follow you to the printer they otherwise would have a difficult time locating and might never suspect." Sophie gave her a pointed look. "Why do you want to talk me out of doing what I know is right?" Anna sat back, picked up her cup, and thought for a moment. "I don't. Really, I don't. But the thought of that man, my hackles rise." "You can be sure I'll take every precaution to avoid him." Anna would have to be satisfied with that much. Chapter 6. Early Sunday morning, Anna came in from checking post-op patients and stretched out on her favorite divan in the parlor,
putting her head back to study the mural on the ceiling. It was the work of a visiting artist who had painted, because he had no other way, he explained at length, of repaying Aunt Quinlan's extraordinary hospitality. Aunt Quinlan was known as a gracious hostess, a supporter of young artists and an easy touch. Any close friend could write a letter of introduction that would open her door, and she had many close friends. Over the years, dozens of young artists had come to call, in need of encouragement and regular feeding and a bed. These young people would stay a few days or a few weeks, and almost all of them left behind a painting or drawing or sculpture of some kind. Mr. McLeish had decided that nothing less than a mural would do, and banished them all from the parlor for a full month while he worked. "And ate," Mrs. Lee pointed out at every opportunity. Mrs. Lee did not like being shut out of the parlor, and she liked even less that Hamish McLeish wouldn't allow her to supervise his progress. By the time the unveiling came around, she was determined not to like whatever he had created, but she gave in with good grace as soon as she saw it. McLeish won Mrs. Lee over by putting Aunt Quinlan, a much younger Aunt Quinlan, extracted from an early self-portrait, in the center of his mural as Mnemosyne, the goddess of memory. "Just so," said Mrs. Lee. "Queens and goddesses forget nothing, except when it suits them." "He was a student of Rossetti's," Aunt Quinlan reminded them. They were sitting in the parlor studying the mural after McLeish had gone on to try his luck in the West. "Obsessed with hair. Masses of it. All of Rossetti's crowd were." He had painted the Muses, too, in a circle around their mother, all draped in flowing jewel-colored robes, and each of them with more hair than any human woman could possibly want. "The hair is well done, but he didn't get your faces quite right." This from Cousin Margaret to Anna and Sophie, delivered with a small sniff. "We didn't know he was using us as models," Sophie said, because it was clear now that Margaret felt ignored. Anna said to her, "I suppose we should be offended that he didn't ask for permission."
"Or for forgiveness," said Aunt Quinlan dryly.
Over the course of the year, Anna had come to like the mural, though she had yet to admit as much to anyone. She liked it, she told herself, because McLeish had cast her in the role of Euterpe, the muse of music. Anna had a tin ear, and a great appreciation for both irony and nonsense. She might have slipped back into sleep if not for a little hand that latched onto her wrist. Leah Russo staked her claim and then clambered like a monkey to tuck herself into the crook of Anna's arm. She came straight from bed, a small bundle of flannel smelling of sleep and lavender talc and little girl. Leah put her head against Anna's shoulder and joined her in her study of the mural. Not yet 2 full days in residence, and the Russo girls had taken over. Or, better said, Leah had taken over. Rosa alternated between hanging back and trying to rein in her sister. When Anna left for the hospital the morning of their first full day on Waverly Place, the moving of furniture had already begun, and when she came home, the discussion of redecorating, of what could be fetched from the attic, of shopping and dressmakers and shoes, was still in full voice. Anna had the sense that this unexpected upheaval in the household was going to suit all of them, once the legalities were worked out. She had the first draft of a letter to the sisters in charge of the asylum sitting on her desk. The writing of letters was something she did a lot of, and easily, but not this time. This time she had to explain the unexplainable, why these two girls in particular, when she saw so many of them day in and day out. To Leah, she said, "Have you had your breakfast?" In response, the 5-year-old pointed at the ceiling.
"Heaven," she said. "Cielo."
"Very good," Anna said, resisting the urge to correct the child's misinterpretation.
The scene above their heads had nothing to do with a Christian heaven. But she was not about to discuss schools of art, Greek